need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is January 5th, 2016, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is We Need Asthma Education. Do, 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 do. We need asthma follow-up. So our guest skeptic today is Chris Carpenter from Washington University. He's the deputy editor of Academic Emergency Medicine and a faculty member of Emergency Medical Abstracts. Happy New Year, Chris.
Hey, Happy New Year, Ken. I'm thrilled to be back on the SGEM for a new episode in a new year.
Well, if you're on the show, we're kickstarting 2016 with another hot off the press.
Yes, indeed. Combating knowledge decay by cutting the KT window down to less than 1 month with the power of social media.
Ah, the power of social media. And you got me hooked up with these people from Academic Emergency Medicine for this project.
Yeah, my grandpa always taught me there's a sucker born every minute. And now you are the social media editor.
Well, hey, not quite yet. That starts in May, but the journal is rebranding itself.
Yes, led by new editor-in-chief Jeff Klein, the AEM editorial board is exploring everything about the journal. Name, appearance, and impact, including alt metrics.
Interesting. Well, I know that the SGEM hop has been a huge success this last year.
Yeah, success that is due in large part to the faithful SGEMers and the article authors who tweet, post on Facebook, and comment on the blog with each new edition of SGEM Hop.
Yeah, and that interaction has propelled the articles covered into the top 20 of all time from Academic Emergency Medicine.
Yeah, based upon altmetrics scores, most SGEM Hop articles wind up in the top 5% of articles for all journals for which altmetrics are computed, and usually the top article in that issue of Academic EM.
Well, let's get this episode started with a case.
Yeah, the 21-year-old with asthma. Since he's 5 years old and he's had a prior intubation at age 8, he presents to your ED with wheezing that has improved, fortunately, with two short breathing treatments with albuterol plus prednisone. He is eagerly awaiting discharge home when you note that he has had 15 visits to your ED for asthma exacerbations over the last 12 months. You ask him if he's following up with his primary care provider and filling his prescriptions for asthma meds, but no. He notes that he has no primary care provider with whom to follow up, no money to pay for prescriptions, and no transportation to get to his doctor's office or the pharmacy. You wonder if anything can be done from the ED to keep this patient at home with minimal asthma symptoms for a prolonged period.
Well, you know what? To provide some background information on the topic, we have one of the top asthma researchers in the world joining us today. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Brian Rowe. Brian is a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Alberta, and he's a Canadian research chair in evidence-based emergency medicine and also the co-editor of the Cochrane Collaboration Airway Review Group. Welcome to the SGEM, Brian.
Thanks very much for having us. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So as an airway disease expert, how common is it for asthma exacerbations to present to the emergency department?
Well, you know, the case that you've given us is really a great example of the kind of problems that patients present with to emergency departments, not only in Canada, but in the United States. It all depends on where you're practicing and what age group you're referring to. In many urban centers in a country like Canada, where access to healthcare is relatively free and unfettered, the rates of asthma presentations have been steadily declining in adults and are stable in children. In many Commonwealth countries like Australia and New Zealand, where action plans and education are endorsed, rates are also fairly low. But in many urban, high-volume US EDs, some South American countries, asthma is still a really common acute respiratory presentation, and it's important for emergency physicians to know the most they can about how to treat this condition.
What kind of burden does this place on the individual and the healthcare system?
Well, again, it depends on where you're practicing and what age group you're referring to. Asthma obviously is more common in children, about twice as common, and admissions to hospital are more common in that age group. In adults, the diagnosis is perhaps a little clearer because people have had it for longer and admissions are less frequent, but quality of life is impaired, work is often missed, and people have a lot of struggles trying to control their asthma. And particularly in certain groups like the poor, the older asthmatics, women, some cultural groups, they seem to have more problems than others. And it's a really important problem, not so much from the mortality perspective, but from the perspective of how you're able to live your life with this condition.
So, Brian, what happens to most of these patients who show up to the emergency department with their asthma exacerbation?
Well, you know, there are lots of guidelines in place for acute and chronic asthma, and fortunately, most patients with asthma will respond to evidence-based treatments in the ED, and I think many emergency physicians provide that kind of care, and they can be safely discharged home. Asthma admission proportions also vary. For example, in Canada, we worked with Carlos Camargo and the MARC group a number of years ago and showed that Canadian admissions are about 10% for adults with acute asthma, whereas in the United States, the proportion is higher at about 20%. And overall, as I said before, children are admitted more frequently than adults. But, you know, when patients come to the emergency department, they get treatments in the emergency department. Sometimes they get x-rays, sometimes they get blood work, and they have a prolonged ED stay in many cases. So, again, it has an impact on the cost of care and people's quality of life.
I'm curious, Brian, what did the guidelines say about post-emergency department discharge?
Well, most of these guidelines, you know, unfortunately are pretty general, and they pay a lot of attention to medical management. So, for example, the role of oral prednisone or systemic corticosteroids in general, the use of short-acting beta agonists, and agents like inhaled corticosteroids or inhaled corticosteroids and long-acting beta agonist combinations. But they pay very little attention to other factors required by patients to regain and maintain control. One of the most important recommendations is early follow-up with a primary care provider. Either, it depends on where you are, that could be in Canada, a primary care physician like a family doctor. In remoter areas, that might be a nurse practitioner, and in some more urban places, it might be an internist. But some kind of follow-up and review of care is critically important to monitor patients' response to therapy, but also to prevent the next exacerbation. Unfortunately, even in Canada, where, again, it's a relatively unencumbered healthcare system, many ED patients either have no family doctor, like your case, or they fail to be reassessed after an ED visit for acute asthma. In our own study in Alberta, patients' median time to follow up was about 19 days, which means 50% of people didn't even get followed up within 3 weeks of their ED visit.
Brian, is there anything else the asthma guidelines recommend doing?
Yeah, there's a ton of other things that we don't spend a lot of time with in the emergency department. The non-pharmacological interventions, such as an asthma action plan, getting people to stop smoking who are asthmatic, getting people into asthma education programs, and doing things like influenza immunization. All of these things are part and parcel of what the asthma recommendations suggest for patients with chronic disease and ways of preventing the next exacerbation. But most emergency departments and docs are really focused on the patient in front of them and how they make sure that they don't run into problems after discharge.
Wow, so seriously, they recommend patient education be done in the chaotic, overcrowded ED?
Yeah, well, I know that people find it strange to believe, but I still do practice emergency medicine, and I completely understand that comment. The majority of guidelines don't actually say where the intervention should take place. So when surveyed by the MARC group a number of years ago, almost every emergency physician group agreed that there was a need for asthma education, like how to use your puffers, how to use an action plan, you know, the pathophysiology of the disease. But they make very little comment in these guidelines about where that intervention should be delivered. And I would argue that many emergency physicians and nurses are ill-equipped to provide really advanced asthma education without training, or, you know, somebody like me who basically does nothing else but respiratory research. So, I mean, the reality is we're not really skilled to do that kind of work, and we know that it needs to be done. So the question is, how do we get it done for those patients? And we've also identified many asthma knowledge gaps, and, you know, this event is considered a teachable moment. And so we're really interested in what is the best way to provide that intervention. Is it in the emergency department? Is it using social media? Is it after the ED? Is it with a clinic, with a physician, or with an educator? So those are some of the questions that still remain outstanding in this field.
Well, you mentioned you're an asthma researcher, and you also mentioned the term teachable moment. So I'm wondering, Brian, is there any evidence that these teachable moments work in the emergency department?
Well, I mean, there's a firm belief in it. There are important recommendations within guidelines. They're not all based on randomized controlled trial or systematic review evidence, but regular review with your primary care physician and the use of an action plan is one of the things that has been shown to reduce future exacerbations. And I think, you know, people have been translating that back to the emergency setting because of this concept that the patient is really in distress. Now, when we talk to patients, they often say they can't remember what they were told in the emergency department. So you may need different modalities. You may need different interventions to make sure that this kind of sticks.
So, Brian, how could education and ED help then?
Well, I think there is some evidence from a Cochrane systematic review that suggests patients in the ED may respond even better than other patients to educational intervention. However, the number of trials involved in this review is small. It's subject to potentially large changes in the results based on additional research. And I think that's one of the reasons why we did this work and why we continue to look at this transitions in care between the emergency department and primary care, and who should deliver the intervention, how intense it should be, how it should be delivered are important questions that still are a little unclear at this point.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for this background information. And isn't it great that we have like a world expert available to give that depth of background information? I know the show will run a little long because of it, but I think the information that you gave, Brian, there was really, really good stuff. So thank you very much. So, Chris, you wanted to mention one more thing before we moved on to the clinical question.
Yeah, Ken, patients give many reasons for missing appointments, but the most common reason that they provide is they just forgot that they had that follow-up appointment.
Yeah, and actually we did a podcast last year looking at a novel idea about using automated text messaging for appointment reminders, and that was SGEM number 102. And we had Dr. Sanjay Arora on, and his team showed the number needed to text. Yes, the NNT was 10. All right, so what's the clinical question?
Can an educational intervention done in the emergency department prior to discharge improve follow-up with primary care providers and asthma patients?
Now I have the pleasure of introducing the lead author of the paper that we will be discussing today. It's Dr. Christina Viza-Roll. Welcome to the SGEM, Christina.
Thanks for having me and for selecting our article to discuss today.
Christina is a physician with an MSc in clinical epidemiology who's nearing the completion of her PhD at the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. She's interested in improving the quality of life for patients with asthma by coordinating transitions in the care between the emergency department and the primary care setting through the delivery of comprehensive and evidence-based care. Christina's research is supported by the Canadian Institutes for Health Research in partnership with the Knowledge Translation Branch. Christina, what got you interested in doing this project?
Well, there is ample evidence in the asthma literature regarding the effectiveness of pharmacologic interventions in the prevention of undesired health-related outcomes. Little attention has been given to the interface between emergency department care and the crucial follow-up that occurs with primary care providers. I felt this was an ideal transition in care to focus on, and this fit in very well with my interest in asthma.
Can you give the actual reference of your paper?
The title of our systematic review was Effectiveness of Educational Interventions to Increase Primary Care Provider Follow-up for Adults Seen in the Emergency Department for Acute Asthma, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. It will be published in Academic Emergency Medicine 2016.
Christina, what was the population that you studied?
Original studies of adult patients discharged from the emergency department after treatment for asthma exacerbation.
And what was your intervention?
Randomized control studies or control studies of any asthma-related education intervention occurring within 1 week of the index emergency department visit for asthma. Interventions ranged from post-emergency department phone call reminding patients of follow-up appointment, 5-day course of steroids plus transport vouchers, faxes from emergency departments to primary care providers with tailored asthma care recommendations, and asthma action plans constructed in the emergency department with patients prior to discharge.
And what was the comparator group that you used?
All studies evaluated the effectiveness of educational interventions compared to usual care. Usual care may include discharge instructions plus medications prescriptions at the discretion of the treating emergency physician.
And what was the primary outcome you were looking for?
It was the percentage of primary care provider office follow-up visits, and the primary care providers could be family physicians, general practitioners, general internists, or nurses.
And did you have secondary outcomes?
Yes. They were the percentage of unscheduled revisits to the office or emergency department for asthma relapses, hospital admissions, time to first primary care provider office visit, and time to first relapse. We also attempted to evaluate the fidelity of the reported educational interventions.
And what were your conclusions?
Emergency department directed educational interventions targeting either patients or providers increased the chance of having office follow-up visits with primary care providers after asthma exacerbations. Their impact on health-related outcomes, such as relapses and admissions, remains unclear.
Thank you. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go through a quality checklist with Chris here for therapeutic systematic reviews, and there's 7 questions. Chris, the first question is, the clinical question, is it sensible and answerable?
Yes, absolutely.
Number 2, the search for the studies, was it detailed and exhaustive?
Yes.
How about the primary studies? Were they of high methodological quality?
No.
And the assessment of the studies, were they reproducible?
Yes.
Do you think the outcomes were clinically relevant?
Unsure. We'll talk about that.
How about the heterogeneity of the primary outcomes?
Yes, there was low statistical heterogeneity.
And the 7th and final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Uncertain.
So let's go through the key results. They had 5 eligible studies totaling 825 patients that were identified, all from the U.S., that was 2 studies, or Canada, 3 studies.
The risk of bias across studies was qualified as unclear, mostly due to the possibility of selective outcome reporting, secondary to the lack of registered protocols, or full text publications.
And the authors were unable to assess the risk of publication bias due to the small numbers of eligible studies.
Yeah, and they used this treatment fidelity assessment grid, and the authors noted using that none of the trials used any behavioral adaptation theory for their educational intervention.
In addition, the details about the educator training protocols and methods to ensure participants' receipt of the educational material was largely lacking.
None of the studies assessed patient compliance with the individual recommendations from the educational intervention.
But Chris, we've got to get to that primary outcome. What was the primary outcome for post-emergency department primary care provider follow-up?
They noted improved compliance with the educational intervention, relative risk 1.6, with minimal statistical heterogeneity.
And that gives you a number needed to treat of 6 for one patient to follow up with their primary care provider at a median of 4 to 6 weeks after the emergency department encounter.
So, Christina, what about the secondary outcomes?
No significant differences were noted between the educational intervention and usual care for asthma relapses, time to asthma relapse, time to first primary care provider visit, and admission rates. Most studies reported no difference in medication compliance between their comparison groups.
And one study reported more patients with a written asthma action plan and higher quality of life scores in the educational arm at 6 months of follow-up.
I think it's important to look at these secondary outcomes in more detail. Despite the fact that there's no statistically significant difference, there are obvious trends here that suggest compelling potential results in the educational arm. For example, the time to asthma relapse was a median of 45 days in the educational arm versus 28 days in the usual care arm. So that's a doubling of the time away from the emergency department for the patients that received the educational intervention. In the admission rates, the relative risk is 0.51, which suggests about a 50% reduction in admission rates. Now, again, not statistically significant, but the confidence intervals go from a potential relative risk reduction of 76% to a worst case scenario of a 6% increased admission rate. So in our feeling is that there are compelling evidence presented here to continue the research in this field, and one or two more studies may clarify these really important health outcomes for patients.
So when you get secondary outcomes like this, it can be really helpful in generating hypotheses. So Christina, have you looked into any of these issues any further?
Yes, we actually just finished a trial in the emergency department with patients with asthma. We hope that those results will clarify these issues.
Ooh, even hotter off the press. Well, we look forward to seeing it published and reviewing it on the SGEM. All right, Chris, one of my favorite parts of this, time to talk nerdy.
Patient education is the basis for effective and meaningful shared decision making, the topic of the consensus conference at Academic Emergency Medicine this year. Unfortunately, ED providers manage patients with widely varying levels of health literacy every day in chaotic settings with scant access to personnel or resources that enable focused pre-discharge educational efforts.
Yeah, Chris, nonetheless, enhanced pre-discharge care must be a priority for efficient patient-centric emergency department operations for medical, psychiatric, surgical, and trauma patients.
Yeah, for all patients. Mm-hmm. Therefore, understanding the effectiveness of pre-discharge interventions in asthma patients provides valuable lessons for researchers, clinicians, and educators across multiple contexts.
And this systematic review suggests that a variety of pre- or immediate post-discharged patient-focused interventions improve primary care provider follow-up rates without compelling evidence of reduced asthma relapse rates, emergency department returns, or hospital admissions.
Differentiating these outcomes is important because increasing follow-up rates, an NT of 6, drives up healthcare costs and resource utilization, which theoretically should improve health via less asthma-related morbidity, but this cause-effect relationship hasn't really been established.
But let's bring Christina and Brian back into the conversation because we had a number of limitations that we wanted to discuss. And the first one that we wanted to discuss was the labor intensiveness of this. These studies used non-clinical personnel to perform the education intervention. They had trained research assistants, study coordinators, or research nurses. And using resources that are not widely available in most emergency departments limits the external validity of these research findings. So more pragmatic research designs will be needed in the future.
Christine and I are going to bounce back and forth with this response, but I think that's an excellent point. As I said before, emergency physicians and most nurses likely don't have the time nor the training to accomplish this goal. And ideally, the use of clinical resources available in the emergency department, like a specialized nurse or a respiratory therapist or health professional liaisons in transitions of care, like asthma educators, pharmacists, or nurse practitioners, should be guided by the needs of patients and local primary care providers. So, for example, in our own city, we have a primary care network where asthma educators exist embedded within the primary care network, and they're quite willing to see these patients for educational interventions afterwards. If you have a big city emergency department in the U.S. and you can show them that this is going to reduce the burden of care for patients, then you may be able to use this evidence to lobby your organization to get resources that you need. We recognize that it's expensive, but when we're thinking about patient-centric, effective, efficient practices, this is one of the ones that we should be thinking about where asthma is common and frequent use of the emergency department is an issue.
And the second point is the theoretical framework. Adapting behavior is complex, and it's more than just giving a lecture at a BEAM course or going to ASAP and hearing somebody speak. Implementation science mandates use of an established educational framework to guide these interventions. None of the studies reported a theoretical framework for the educational intervention.
Again, I think there's a couple of issues here. First of all, these projects are research projects that are submitted for publication in peer-reviewed journals. There may be more information about the theoretical framework in the proposals, in the documents that the authors have. We weren't able to obtain them, and most of these trials were not registered, so we weren't able to get that information. So one, it may be an issue with publication, but you're right. An unclear theoretical foundation of many educational trials in asthma has been strongly criticized, and difficulties in replication and limited applicability may be associated with this issue. So we agree completely with your comment. It is an important consideration for the implementation.
Yeah, and there's more layers of complexity, too, that future authors should try to look at. And those include the cultural capacity for change within an institution, who the essential stakeholders and opinion leaders are that need to be engaged to implement change, how adaptable the intervention is, and when you adapt it, when does it become a different intervention, and how sustainable is it across different healthcare settings. None of this is reportable in the systematic review because, like you said, the authors didn't report it.
again, you're correct, and it's unfortunate that we couldn't summarize these elements in the article. Obviously, these steps should be performed before the implementation, so you wouldn't go into the effort of an implementation without this kind of work done as your groundwork. Again, in defense of the authors, it may have been completed, but it just wasn't put into the trial report. You know, it's important. We've been working diligently on our own interventions, and we've looked at potential facilitators and barriers for the implementation of interventions in the emergency department prior to incorporating them into practice. And it's really important to look at those things, anticipate them, and try to provide interventions to reduce the barriers when you're putting these things into place.
The third thing I wanted to mention was about the fidelity of the intervention itself. None of the studies reported the fidelity of their intervention. And what I mean by that is the vigor, the timing, the engagement, the clarity of the asthma education. There was not enough detail in there to differentiate which were the interventions that were effective versus ineffective.
In our article, we made considerable efforts to describe the fidelity of the interventions. However, we failed to identify detailed information. Consequently, we called for a standardized description and evaluation of proposed interventions in future reports. Analysis focused on one or more of the fidelity domains could reveal important changes in effect sizes.
The fourth issue is health literacy. The number needed to treat for the intervention was 6, but none of the studies reported whether patients understood or followed the ED educational recommendations, nor did they assess what happened during the PCP follow-up visit. Better understanding these events and understanding will be essential to establishing a cause-effect relationship between ED education and patient-oriented outcomes.
The issue of literacy needs to be determined before the intervention is implemented and was not reported in these trials. We're similarly concerned that simply being seen by a primary care provider is as effective as seeing a primary care provider with interest and training in asthma education. The effectiveness of the intervention does depend to some degree on the skills and resources available to the primary care providers at the time of the follow-up.
And the fifth and final point I wanted to bring up was that of texting. What about using this technology for asthma education and encouraging follow-up? I mean, you could text the asthma information while at the same time reminding the patient of their primary care follow-up. Sanjay Arora, like we mentioned earlier, demonstrated a number needed to text of 10. And perhaps you could embed some of that asthma education into the text reminder.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm one of those who believes that the shoe phone from Get Smart was really the most innovative intervention ever developed, and I'm still using it. So texting is not a familiar thing for me, except when I'm texted to bring milk home. Anyway, it has been shown to be an effective delivery method for educational interventions, but you can't apply it to everything, and I think you need to consider your target population, the purpose of your intervention. So we've learned lots from engaging patients and knowledge users, particularly primary care providers, in our own research initiatives in asthma and exploring their needs and expectations. In our research, patients appear to prefer, at least in asthma, because it's a very complex condition, having one-on-one discussions with physicians and text was not the preferred method. And I think if we're going to do this, We need to do an intervention, a pragmatic trial that's focused on texting, because asthma is not just, hey, you need to follow up with your family doctor. There's all sorts of complexity to the disease. And even if you really focused on say, smoking cessation on this visit, and you missed the fact that the person was not compliant with their inhaled corticosteroid preventer medication, that person would have a relapse. And so it's a very complicated disease with multiple triggers. And I think if we're going to say we should be texting these people, we need to have evidence that it works in this condition.
Well, thanks, Brian and Christina, for answering our 5 questions about the limitations of the study. At this point, we go on and comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
We think a variety of ED educational interventions appear to improve primary care provider follow-up rates. But which interventions, applied to which patients, in what settings, that's somewhat nebulous. The external validity of these findings in EDs without dedicated research personnel is also unknown, as is the link between asthma education and asthma-related morbidity in the months following an asthma exacerbation episode of care.
So, Chris, give us a bottom line then.
So, educating asthma patients about warning signs, acute medical management, follow-up recommendations, and indications to return to the ED for reevaluation are important components of quality emergency care for any condition. Available studies indicate that a variety of pre- or immediate post-discharge efforts by research personnel improve primary care provider follow-up rates. whether these efforts reduce short-term asthma-related morbidity, like relapsing symptoms, ED returns, hospitalization, largely unproven.
So, Chris, can you give us a case resolution?
Sure. You explain the diagnosis, prescriptions, symptoms to monitor, and reasons to return to the ED, and rationale for an engaged primary care team with this patient. You then ask him to explain these elements of his asthma care back to you, the teach-back method. Next, the ED social worker is able to provide the patient with a new inhaler and a four-day course of steroids, plus a CAB voucher for his follow-up appointment, which the ED case manager has scheduled with the medicine clinic. You discharge the patient hoping that his next ED visit is many years away and perhaps unrelated to his asthma.
So how are you going to take this actual paper and apply it clinically then, Chris?
Well, working with my nurse educator, our ED develops a nurse-led asthma discharge education protocol that includes teach-back, understanding of asthma care received in the ED, prescriptions provided, indications for each prescription, available primary care providers, so access to care, and access to transportation for both prescriptions and primary care provider office follow-up.
So here's how I'm going to translate this information then at the bedside. Here's what I might tell a patient. Asthma is a common lung disease, and an asthma attack can happen throughout your life. And sometimes we're able to find the trigger, but often we can't. And if you understand your asthma better, you can have less attacks, which could be less severe. And this could mean fewer trips to the emergency department, a better quality of life, less sick days lost from work, and even prevent you from being admitted to the hospital. And our asthma nurse is going to come and talk to you about some key elements before you go home. This brings us to the Keener contest. Last week's winner was David Hedman. David knew that British sailors were called limeys because of the lime juice added to their watered-down rum to prevent scurvy. Christina, what's the Keener contest this week?
What company is credited with inventing the modern-day metered dose inhaler that is commonly used to deliver asthma medication?
An asthma question. What a surprise. Well, if you know the answer to this question, then send it to the sgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, I have a couple of conferences I wanted to mention. And the first one is Ski Beam, which will be at Sun Peaks, British Columbia, February 1st to 3rd. And then I'm going to be at Emergency Medical Abstract Conference at Key West, Florida, February 8th to 12th.
Yeah, SAM is in New Orleans. May 10th is the consensus conference on shared decision making. May 11th through the 13th is the annual meeting for SAM.
Well, thanks, Brian, for coming on to the SGEM.
Well, thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Christina, for participating in the Hot Off the Press episode.
Thanks again for having us.
SGEMers, make sure you start tweeting, posting, and commenting. Time is ticking. You have 1 week. The best SOMI comments will be published.
Well, as an added bonus, Christina, the guest skeptic gets to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical on anything you learn, even if you've heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.